Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
This is an encore edition of Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer. Conductor Keith Lockhart will soon discover whether his audience is mesmerized or just thinking about dinner. Maestro Lockhart, along with musicians in the Boston Symphony Orchestra and some of their audience members, were outfitted with special sensors in an unusual attempt to monitor emotional responses to pieces like this one by Mozart. Now, the results won't be available for a few more months, but the study raises some interesting questions about how engaged you really are when sitting in a concert hall. Joining us on the line this afternoon is Dr. Daniel Levitin, a musician himself, and a cognitive neuroscientist at McGill University in Montreal. He's also one of the researchers. Daniel, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi, how are you, John?
Okay. What were the main questions that you were trying to answer with this research?
Well, we were really looking at a number of different things that I think are on the minds of many music listeners. One is when the conductor is feeling a certain emotion or intending to communicate it to the musicians, to what extent is that faithfully received by them as it was intended? And then in the next stage of communication, how accurately are the emotions of the musicians passed on to the audience?
Hmm. So it's like a musical game of telephone.
Exactly.
Wow.
There are a host of questions, one of them being that, do the musicians tend to amplify or attenuate the emotional signal, as it were, that the conductor is putting out? And do the audience members receive this emotional signal with the same impact?
So how do you go about measuring this sort of thing?
Well, ideally, we'd put everybody in a brain scanner, one of these fMRI or PET machines that that we all read about in the papers these days. But you can't move in those things. So we're forced to rely on secondary measures of brain activity, such as we get from the skin. We call these collectively psychobiological measures. And we can pick up a number of things from the skin that correlate with emotion and with arousal.
Is this sort of along the lines of polygraph technology?
Right. It's a little more multidimensional than that, but yes, it's essentially in the same family of things.
So it's measuring body temperature, pulse, volume of blood, things
exactly.
Like that?
Exactly. Respiration. We have on the musicians and the conductor accelerometers that tell us how much they're moving back and forth. And on all the participants, we have galvanic skin response. It turns out that the amount that you sweat is correlated with the amount of emotion you're feeling.
Mm-hmm. But now, I mean, the question is, as we put at the beginning of the show, you know, is the audience really into the music, or are they thinking about what they're going to do for dinner? I suppose if your mind is wandering and you're particularly excited about, lobster thermidor and your skin, you start to sweat a little, the blood starts pumping, won't that kind of skew your results? I mean, you don't really know what is causing that reaction.
Absolutely. And this is why we have to have as many subjects, we call them subjects in experimental psychology, but I mean, they're participants in the experiment. We need to have as many as possible. So that these kinds of random effects are spread out and hopefully diluted by the larger number of readings that we get. So, for example, one person in the audience might be enthusiastically thinking about their lobster thermidor just by chance, but that might be balanced by another member of the audience who is being put to sleep or dreading having to go home and do their tax return.
Right.
So these kinds of random factors over a great number of people ought to balance each other out. And you find these in all in almost every study that you read, whether it's a study on the effects of a new drug or a study of somebody in a brain scanner who's mentally practicing their tennis serve,
right,
there are always these random effects, and we just have to figure that over a large number of people, they'll cancel out.
So you think you have a large enough group of people between the conductor, the musicians, and the audience members. Who was the control group?
Well, that's a good question. There is a control group in a sense, and it's I guess I prefer to call it a comparison group because it gets to another hypothesis that we're testing, and that is the difference between experiencing a concert live and experiencing one that's been pre-recorded. So we shot high-quality video and we recorded CD-quality stereo audio at Symphony Hall, and a separate group of audience members in a few weeks is going to experience this concert for the first time, but over essentially a large flat panel television screen. So what we're holding constant here is the musical pieces performed. In fact, the actual performance is identical.
Mm-hmm.
We're also holding constant that you're going to be a part of an audience. So the communal aspect of experiencing a concert is the same. What's different is that you're not really there hearing it live. And we're hoping to be able to quantify to some extent the difference there.
Oh, interesting. All right, we're speaking with Daniel Levitin, a musician and also cognitive neuroscientist at McGill University in Montreal, one of the researchers behind this unusual study. You chose a Boston Pops program, a family concert, right, Daniel?
It was actually the BSO, the Boston Symphony, but it was, as you say, it was part of their family series. And that was largely a matter of what we were able to get. The Symphony Hall has a very crowded schedule, and we signed up Maestro Lockhart first, and he brought, he had worked with a member of our team before, and he's a very enthusiastic supporter of this kind of scientific research. As he said from the podium in his announcement Saturday, this kind of research can ultimately teach us all more about the most important musical instrument there is, the human brain.
Mm.
So Lockhart brought the idea of the project to the BSO, and this is the concert that everybody thought would work the best.
All right, and it was a concert that featured some familiar music. We heard a little bit of Mozart's Marriage of Figaro Overture. It also included this famous symphony by Mozart. All right, so the ending of the Jupiter Symphony by Mozart here. Daniel Levitin, the familiarity or unfamiliarity of the pieces, do you have any sense of whether that's going to play into the kind of reactions that you get from the audience members, especially who have these sensors on them that are measuring their responses?
Well, again, you asked exactly the right question a moment ago when you asked about scientific control. So the reason we had a program that included familiar tunes, like the Mozart pieces, as well as unfamiliar, two new pieces by Robert Capello, was that we wanted to balance out these factors as controls for one another. So one might argue that an audience member, or for that matter a musician, who is experiencing a musical piece for the 40th time, may have a qualitatively and quantitatively different emotional response than if they're experiencing a piece for the first time, which was largely the case with the two Capello pieces, Green Eggs and Ham and Gertrude McFuzz.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have to do a comparison of familiar versus unfamiliar, and I'm not sure what we'll find. There are issues about whether the musicians are somewhat not jaded or numbed, but maybe have a reduced reaction for something they've played so often as the Jupiter Symphony.
Right. There's also the idea that our reactions to these pieces changes over time. I mean, the way people react to Mozart's music now in the 21st century is certainly very different from the kind of galvanizing response that he got from his contemporary audience back in the 1790s.
I'm glad you said that, because I think one of the most powerful things about all music, from classical to pop and hip-hop, is that each time we hear a piece, even a familiar one that we've heard 1,000 times, we're bringing a new set of experiences to it, and our brains have changed somewhat. I mean, our brains are changing all the time. And so I believe that every time we hear a piece of music, we're experiencing it somewhat differently, let alone the 300-year difference in culture and in exposure to different musics.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that whatever results come of this research, that they will be applicable across all genres of music, whether you're a rock fan, jazz, world music, classical?
You know, I wouldn't go that far. In fact, I would go quite a bit less far than that, because I don't want to oversell the generality of this particular experiment. I think all of us who were participating in it think of it as really just a preliminary, cautious first step in the direction of measuring music in a real-life, sort of ecologically valid environment. And as Keith said, ultimately one would want to expand this study to include different kinds of musicians, maybe the entire orchestra. And different kinds of music, the kinds of music that might be more challenging to many listeners, like a Mahler symphony, Stravinsky's Rites of Spring, something that can be, a piece of music can be a life-changing experience for a person. Mozart can be, but some of these other more challenging pieces might bring a greater range of emotional reaction and surprise. And then if you want to talk about U2 or about Busta Rhymes, I mean, all bets are off. Who knows what's going on there? It really would be necessary to study music in all different kinds of environments. I think the strength of this approach, though, is that, traditionally over the last 30 or even 100 years, most of the way that scientists study these kinds of phenomena, or visual phenomena, that matter, are that we take people into a sterile laboratory, usually a small white room with no windows. We take them out of their natural environment and we make them look at very artificial, contrived images, or listen to artificial and contrived series of sign tones, like boop, 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 beep, beep, and that's supposed to stand in for music.
Right.
We gain a lot of scientific control, but I fear that we're losing a lot of the essence of what the phenomena are under study.
So was this the first time that someone has taken the laboratory into the concert hall?
As far as we know, it's the first time anybody's done it with these sensors. A colleague of mine on this project, Steve McAdams, did something like this a year ago in Paris with a piece called The Angel of Death, written by the California composer Roger Reynolds.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have sensors in the audience, but the audience had slider boxes. And they moved these little faders, these knobs up and down in response to the music, answering certain questions such as, have you heard this musical theme before? Or in real time, the audience would indicate how emotional they were feeling.
And what from a general kind of audience standpoint, someone who is not a cognitive neuroscientist, as you are, Daniel, what do they get out of it? What's their takeaway from the potential results of this research? Are there broader applications outside the musical field?
Well, I think there are. We know relatively little about the brain compared to, say, what we know about the lungs or the kidneys. We don't know much about its structure or how it's wired up or the ways in which different brain regions orchestrate with one another to create thought, to create feelings. So experiments like this provide a window into the functioning of the human brain, and ultimately we can use knowledge based on this to help repair people with brain damage that might result from strokes or lesions or tumors. I think the other thing is that an added application is that musicians are always wondering to what extent their intentions are reaching the audience. And if we can give them some sort of feedback about that, which happened in the Reynolds project and hopefully will come out of this, musicians may be able to better hone or adjust their playing to really communicate what they intend. Hmm. In a sense, it's like a biofeedback system.
Yeah. All right. Well, the results when they appear are something that we will be looking at pretty keenly. And Daniel Levitan, we'll have to have you back when the results are finally published.
I look forward to it, John.
In the meantime, we've been speaking with Daniel Levitan. He's professor of psychology and music at McGill University in Montreal and one of the researchers taking part in the study this past weekend at the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And this is Soundcheck. We'd like to hear what you think. You can email us. soundcheck@wnyc.org. Coming up in a moment, Bollywood superstar Asha Bhosle. She is reportedly the world's most recorded singer with more than 20,000 songs. Then, composer Michael Galasso discusses his latest collaboration with dramatist Robert Wilson. It's a new score for Henrik Ibsen's Peer Gynt. This is Soundcheck. You're listening to an encore edition of Soundcheck. Thanks for listening to Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Every day we dig into what's happening in music, and you can hear everything we do and check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. All of this is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.